This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. Today we have a guest on, Sherry Hunkela, who is the vice presidential candidate for the Green Party. She and Jill Stein, who is the presidential candidate for the Green Party, who you probably never hear about or might not have even heard of at all, were arrested the other day attempting to assert their rights to be on a debate stage with the two corporate candidates. So we'll have her on and talk to her about the whole issue of the debates and her platform and her candidacy in just a little while. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up. All right, this is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. Don't forget to join us on the Occupied Territory Facebook page. Just Google Occupied Territory and Facebook, and you will get right to it. The debate is constantly going on. We have all kinds of opinions, videos that people do themselves or that they point us to, various links, and this is the election season, obviously, and there is a lot of discussion going on there. Also, there are still things happening outside the corporate debate structure, so actual real things by real people, and we talk about that on Occupied Territory. In fact, that's what the point of the of this show, and although we'll talk about what's going on with the Democrats and the Republicans, we're trying to think bigger or around them or through them or over them so that one day we can actually get an actual equal and democratic society. So check out Occupied Territory on Facebook and participate. And just the other day, now as far as the Green Party candidate goes, Jill Stein is running for president, and a woman named Sherry Hunkela, who, if we connect with her today, she's supposed to call in, is the vice presidential candidate, and she can speak for herself, so I'm not going to introduce her yet when she comes on. It, just the other day, they were arrested outside the debate area in at Hofstra University, where I went to college. I went there when it was Hofstra College, which was a very sort of low-level grade B, easy to get into, easy to get out of, business school and elementary education major type school. So it was sort of paddling along, but it had dreams of glory, which apparently it has realized. There was a lot of money from the alumni at Hofstra, and they hired they hired, just about the time I was there, too, which was fortunate for me, they hired, paid a lot of money out for young professors, actually, you know, adjunct professors and instructors who later on became assistant professors and professors. They hired people from Ivy League schools or interviewed people who were from really good schools and came in and really rejuvenated the place. And that was what they built the foundation of what is now Hofstra University, with a law school, much expanded, to say the least. It was a tiny little college out on Long Island, and not much intellectual activity going on out there. Also, a very right-wing place. When I was, I noticed in the paper the other day, they had, in the Times, they had a picture and a whole description of Hofstra University and what was happening out there, and the turmoil and the ferment on campus, which there was hardly any of when I was there. And this is right in the middle of the Vietnam War. And they mentioned the Young Democrats and somebody who was the president. I was the president of the Young Democrats at Hofstra University Hofstra College in 1965 and 1966. So this is when the Vietnam War had really exploded. And we were considered to be a subsidiary, a kind of an auxiliary of the Democratic Party, you know, organization. And there was a Democratic Party in Nassau County, which at the time was the richest county in the United States, and basically a Republican county. And it was considered to be very right-wing, and it was. It was very at least conservative, if not actually right-wing. I mean, it had, you know, voted against President Kennedy, I think, in the 1960 election. But they had a very powerful a person who had been a friend of the Kennedys, a very powerful guy who was running the Democratic Party machinery out there. And he had really given them a run. So it was, you know, very strong. And then, of course, Johnson was president at the time I was there. So I was president of the Young Democrats, and the war comes along. And I was supposed to go down there about once every month to get a little bit of a briefing from this guy. John English was his name, the head of the Democratic Party in Nassau County. And I went down there, and he would tell me what's happening with the club. We had about this is a place where they had, you know, football sororities, football fraternities and sororities, and it was everything. Sports was everything. They had a football team. They had an active, overwhelming ROTC program, Reserve Officers Training Corps. And because the government had given Hofstra College either all the land or most of the land that or leased to them at, you know, like at minimal cost, they leased it from the federal government. It had been, I think, an airfield or a training field during the war, in World War II. And they leased this this property to them right before it and during World War II. And that's where they built it on. So part of the deal was that Hofstra had to give back to the federal government the fact that every male who went to Hofstra, where the debate took place the other night, had to be in the Reserve Officers Training Corps. Everybody had to join ROTC, right? And the only way you could get out of it is if you were physically incapacitated or you were in the marching band. So, since there was no way I was going to wear a uniform and be in the Reserve Officers Training Corps in a million years, and since I was in the high school orchestra, when I joined, when I went to Hofstra, I immediately joined the concert band and the marching band. And we had to march at all the football games. We played in the cement ball. we had to march in the football game. We had to march in formations. We made, at Christmas, when we marched down the field, we actually had to assume the shape of a turkey. Now, whether or not we were actually assuming the shape of a turkey is beyond me. I was down there. I was in the beak of the turkey as we marched down the field playing, you know, whatever the Hofstra marching song was. I played the trombone. And we wore blue blazers. This is the school colors were blue and gold, right? So I had a, it makes me feel like I came from outer space to think of it now. Here was, I was 19 years old, 20 years old. I had a blue, I've never worn anything in my life but jeans and a flannel shirt or a T-shirt when it gets hot. That's it. And sneakers, period. Except for the few times I worked in an office where I had to wear other clothes. So here I am. I wear white buck shoes. Like something from, you know, like a 1960s rock and roll movie. I had to wear white buck shoes, and I had to wear, let's see, pressed blue slacks, a blue blazer with a gold emblem of Hofstra with a crown and God knows what else. The school was created in 1936, so it wasn't very ancient. But they had a coat of arms, of course, and everything. And let's see, white shirt. Red and gold or blue and gold tie. Unbelievable, right? And it's supposed to play, and we played in freezing weather and everything. So it was a nowhere, so it wasn't much of a school. But they did hire these really intelligent, really intellectual, really active young teachers from Harvard, from Yale, from Stanford, from all over the place. Paid them a huge salary, which is why they came there, right? And when they got there, they realized what kind of student body they had, which was basically conservative, small-minded, not very bright business majors from all over Long Island. You know, people who were the children of a lot of guys who had made it in business or people who had a lot of money whose kids couldn't get into better schools. And that's who they were dealing with, right? And then most of the girls who went there, this is after all, it was, we're talking about 1962, which is essentially the 50s. Most of the girls who went there went there either to meet somebody, to meet a boy, to get married to, so they'd have a nice house, you know, and a swimming pool and a nice car and everything and kids and a family. Or they were going to study to be, if they're going to study to be anything, what did they study there? The girls all studied elementary education. They studied to be elementary school teachers. And that's the kind of school it was. So the teachers got there, they were appalled. All these guys got there from, and women, from Yale, Harvard, Stanford, wherever, Columbia, and came for the money, found out that they were teaching a bunch of dunces and got very depressed. But then the school started recruiting people as best they could who were a little bit smarter. And, you know, yeah, so a bunch of us went there who got scholarships, who got, you know, who couldn't get into other schools because our grades weren't good. But still, they sort of carefully recruited people who were intelligent and interested in things and generally very liberal. So this was a new infusion. This was a new thing for that place. So when I went there, the teachers, you know, concentrated on us. So we would have these I had these really great classes because I'd sit in a class with 20 people in an English lit class or a political science class. And, you know, 90% of the kids were didn't understand what was going on or falling asleep or trying to figure out if they could throw a football and get away with it, right? And so a couple of us would have these classes with these teachers. Sometimes it would go so far as they would we'd meet outside in the spring. And the teachers, knowing the complete lack of interest that these kids had or ability to understand what they were talking about or what they wanted to talk about, literally sent the kids off, said, you know, you got somewhere to go. You go wherever you want. And he stuck around. He stuck around and just talked to a couple of us. It was great to have these two or three or four person sort of like discussions or seminars with these teachers. So eventually I become being interested in politics, especially when the war got going, right, and after Kennedy and all. I became the president of the Young Democrats. What does that mean? It was like 20 people in this club, right? And believe me, this is a school of, I don't know what, several hundred, a thousand people. There was 20 people in the Young Democrats. To be a Democrat in Nassau County in those days was almost a dangerous thing to be. Well, one thing we did in 1964 to, you know, somehow do our part with all the voter registration down south was we went into town called Hempstead, which was very poor, the parts of Hempstead out there, which is where the school is located and where they went the other day to debate. Extremely poor. It was one of the most poverty-stricken areas of Nassau County, which was, as I said, the richest county in the country. I mean, you know, generally speaking. And mostly a black neighborhood. So we go in there, and we're passing out me and a couple of, you know, people that I recruited from the club are passing out voter registration forms in this area so people could vote, right? And the cops show up one day while we're passing out leaflets, grab the leaflets, throw them up in the air all over the street, and throw us up against the gated, the locked gates of a couple of stores. One, two, three, bam, bam, bam. And the cop says, you're not going to distribute this communist filth anymore, are you? And I just stared at him, right? And I was out there the next day. And so finally they came around and they instructed us. This time somebody must have said something. So they instructed us without throwing us against a wall this time that they didn't want to see us on the street anymore. So we had to get the Democratic Party headquarters involved. Eventually what happened was I started setting up in 65 comes and then, you know, January of 66. I start setting up a table in the quadrangle, you know, right outside the cafeteria where everything was happening, you know, and instead of a football rally thing, I set up a big table against the war to give people information about what was going on there and set it up against the war. So the ROTC student colonel who had a buzz cut, you know, he weighed about 200 pounds and he was about 5'8". And, you know, he's wearing his uniform. He's the colonel. And he comes over with the guys on a football team who are in the ROTC. Same old crowd, right? Wherever you go. And they walk over to the table. He says, are you a commie? Stupidity. The largest tribe in the world. You know about tribal warfare in Afghanistan and tribal warfare here and tribes there and tribes here? The largest tribe in the world, was it international tribe related very closely to each other, are idiots. So this guy, you know, walks up to me. He says, are you a commie? I said, I'm telling people about the war. You know, get out of my face, right? He says, you're a traitor and you're a commie. And kicks the whole table over, pulls the legs off, and throws, you know, the pamphlets all over the ground. and had to be instructed by the dean of students not to, to allow us to do this, right? Meanwhile, I get called into the Democrat, long story short, I get called into the Democratic Party headquarters by this guy, John English, who was a friend of the Kennedys, you know, and by, at this time it was like Robert Kennedy, right? And what's interesting is that Robert Kennedy was running for Senate in 1964, and he's part of the reason why I got interested in politics in the first place, joined the Young Democrats, and felt that it was worthwhile. Because Bobby Kennedy came out there in 1964 when he was running for Senate He was running for a Senate seat. I think it was 1964. And he comes out to Hofstra. He spoke at Hofstra. It's New York State, right? And he wanted to speak to some students. And this was after his brother had been killed, you know. And he had a radical change. I mean, he had been a right winger. He had been the worst. He was an attorney. As a young attorney, he was a counsel on, I forget, either for McCarthy or for the House Un-American Activities Committee. I mean, he was as bad as it gets, Bobby Kennedy, right? A real pig. He worked with Hoover and everybody else. It's funny when you think of what happened between Hoover and his brother later on. But that's how he started out in the political world, Bobby Kennedy, as a counsel to right-wing committees in the Capitol. So then he's, after his brother is killed, he started to have a transformation and became one of the most inspiring, and he was passionate, this guy, and smart and mesmerizing. You know, he was really something. In fact, he was less of a performer than his brother and more sincere when he got up there and talked. You had a feeling, instead of putting on a good show like Jack Kennedy did, and nobody put on a better show except Clinton, maybe, or along with Clinton. But when Bobby Kennedy got up there, he wasn't acting. He wasn't fooling around. Yeah, he wanted to get votes, but he didn't crack jokes all over the place. He didn't have that charming smile. He got up there and he spoke passionately from the heart, and he was brilliant too. And he came out to Hofstra, and I sat there in the audience. I was a sophomore then, and watched him speak and listened to him speak. After that, I joined the Young Democrats. I said, "Well, if there are Democrats like this, I'm joining the Democrats." So, gets to be 65, 66. The war already a sham and intolerable and wrong, right? I set up my little table, like people shoving me around, spitting at me, yelling at me, calling me names. I guess I was always perverse. Well, I thought one way to look at it. The other way is maybe I was just doing the right thing, right? I thought I was. In fact, I was. But I get called into Democratic Party headquarters. There are complaints from somebody. He says, "You got to stop putting that table up there. Our policy," this is under Johnson, right? The Democratic policy under Johnson, he says, "Our policy," quote unquote, "our policy," whoever the R is not to oppose the war. We have to support our president. And I said, "Not in a million years. This is wrong, this war." He said, "You work for me. The Young Democrats are part of the Democratic Party." And I said, "No more, not at Hofstra." And he said, "You punk kids." You know, this guy had been a Marine in World War II. This is who you're dealing with, right? You don't know anything about the world, about war. What do you know? I said, "I know this is wrong." And we got into like a shouting match. And then I walk off. And so I kept doing it, right? And they excommunicated me from the Democratic Party. I was going to go to hell. They excommunicated me. I couldn't be a real... So that's sort of when I diverged. That was the beginning point of when I took off, left of the Democratic Party. Because I thought, they're just playing ball. They're murdering people, right? Does this sound familiar, like now? Looks like either Sherry is busy, or maybe she's been rearrested. I don't know. But Sherry, who I interviewed on Sirius, Sherry Hunkala, who is the vice presidential candidate, was supposed to call in, but hasn't yet. She may yet, I don't know. But she and Jill Stein, the other day, went over to the debate. Now, according to, recently, you may have read this. Some people read these political things. I read them because I'm interested, and then I also read them for homework because I have political shows on the radio. But there's something called the Committee on Presidential Debates, or Commission. They make it sound absolutely governmental and official, right? The Commission on Presidential Debates. Now, up until around 1988, the presidential debates were organized and run by a completely nonpartisan or bipartisan, mostly nonpartisan organization called the League of Women Voters, which was a very important, powerful group in this country. Somewhat diminished now, but still important and powerful, which gives information to voters, urges people to vote, makes it easier for people to get to the polling places, does not back candidates, right? if you would ask them all, I'm sure probably it would turn out that they were generally Democrats or liberals, but they didn't, you know, they did the right thing. They just urged people to go vote. They made it easy for people to register. They didn't care where it was or who it was. That was not their job. Was the higher goal of democracy, get people to vote. So they've been running these debates for a long, long time, organizing them, running them, figuring out who would produce them, how, what the rules would be on stage, who would be involved. And here and there, there were, you know, I don't know if there were ever a history of third-party candidates. I don't know how long they've been running it either. If you go back, the last, aside from Ross Perot, who was a blip on the radar, right, you have to go back way back to the 1940s with Henry Wallace, I think it was, 1948, with separate candidates, important candidates who were allowed to be included in debates and who were covered by the media. But so from 48 all the way up until Ross Perot, I don't think there was a third party candidate, although I could be wrong. Nevertheless, the League of Women Voters ran this in a completely nonpartisan way. And one way or another, politically somehow, that was a little loose, out of control of the two major political parties, the two major political corporations, Democrats, incorporated and Republicans incorporated. That was out of their control. They didn't like it. And there was always the threat of a third party candidate, right? And, making it easy for them to get on the ballot and everything else. So they took over all of this. I mean, first of all, they've changed all the rules and the laws. So it's much harder than it used to be for an American who wants to run for office in their own country and change things to get on a ballot. Of course it's harder. They don't want you in the boardroom. They don't want you to have a chance to run your own country. They own it. They run it. You shut up. As far as they're concerned, you're like a shareholder at a corporation shareholder meeting. You have no power over anything. You vote the way they tell you, and if you don't, you can stand up for 2 minutes or 1 minute before they cut your microphone off or escort you out at some shareholder meeting in, you know, some big city, and stand up and tell the CEO he shouldn't be getting $100 million a year with bonuses and salaries while people are making $7 an hour in all the factories or plants or, you know, stores or wherever. But that's how they want to treat, you know, voters. Just shut up, do what we tell you, or go away. And so they made it hard. But the League of Women Voters encouraged people. They were sort of an encouraging, facilitating group. And then the Democratic and Republican parties took over in 1988, effectively, and established this Presidential Commission on Debates. And the Presidential Commission on Debates sets up all the rules. It tells you who can vote. Who can be in the debate, and basically who can be in the debate? Only a Democrat, only a Republican. That's it. So when you see these other debates, I don't know how it works in terms of primaries, but when you see debates where there are candidates running, and even in primaries, like in the Democratic primary, Democrats do this separately, and Republicans do this separately too. They discriminate against anybody who isn't on the inside, who isn't in top management, so to speak. So, for instance, people like Dennis Kucinich and other people get frozen right off the debate stage when there were primary debates. The Republicans seemed to be a little bit fairer. They included all these people, these nuts and these idiots like Herman Cain and, Michelle Bachmann and this moron Rick Perry. All these people were included. And then people who had more legitimate, although sometimes frightening things to say, like Ron Paul. Was it RuPaul? Ron Paul. Yes, I know. And so everybody is up there talking, and even John Huntsman, who is considered a communist by the rest of the Republican Party because he believes that people shouldn't go around killing everybody all over the place and there should be safety nets. So they included them all. So they were fairer in a way. The Democrats have been worse. They have frozen off anything that has to do with the very liberal or left wing of their party. It's all complete corporate centrism in the Democratic Party. That's it. It's been going on that way for 15, 20, 30 years now. That's how it is. So they get together, Commission for Presidential Debates. They set the rules. They say who can be on the stage. Nobody can be on the stage except for them. Now, according to the Commission on Public Debates, I am reading from here. The presidential debates are the first opportunity. I'm reading an article here for millions of voters to see the candidates themselves, not just their advertising campaigns. Of course, people in the Green Party or the Libertarian Party, there's a candidate named Gary Johnson, who's a former governor of New Mexico on the Libertarian Party. and people on the Green Party, they can't be in debates, right? They don't have the money to put on TV ads, you know, here locally once in a while on, you know, some local radio station. But they don't have the billions of dollars, you know, the hundreds of millions, even the billions of dollars to swamp major TV stations and newspapers and everything else with ads. The debates are organized by Commission on Presidential Debates, CPD. Sounds like an illness. You have advanced CPD? A supposedly nonpartisan entity, which is a puppet of and serves interests of the Democrats. This is probably from Alternet that I got this. Republicans and the big corporations that fund both of them. The major sponsor of the Republican debates, you know how, like, sometimes you'll see Avis Rent-A-Car is the official rent-a-car company of the New York Yankees. Or, you know, you go to a ball game and it's AT&T Stadium. Private companies own everything now, right? The public be damned. So the major funder, the major commercial sponsor of the presidential debates, you know, our president that's supposed to represent us, that we vote for, the major sponsor was Anheuser-Busch. Which is very, you know, which is not as bad as Coors, but on Anheuser-Busch, right-wing enough. Okay, the Commission on Public Debates criteria to be included in these debates is designed to exclude independent presidential contenders who promote ideas that are that challenge those in power. Now, listen to this. The debates must include, this is from the Commission on Presidential Debates that the Republicans and the Democrats set up. The debates must include every candidate who is on enough ballots to win the White House, okay, who's on enough ballots. That's not enough, you know, approximate voters. But if you're just registered, the Green Party is on 85% of the state ballots in this country. I forget how many states, 44 states or something like that. They're on 85% of the ballots, which is, you know. So this is you have to be on enough ballots to win the White House. And you have to demonstrate a minimal level of support, meaning either 1% of the vote in a credible national poll or qualification for federal matching funds or both in the statement. In 2012, the Green and Libertarian Party candidates both meet all of these criteria, all of them. They're on enough of the ballots. They clearly, each one has at least 1% of the national vote by any poll or estimate. But you won't see that in polls. I'll get to that in a minute. And you won't hear that reported in the news. So they qualify for all of this, and they are legitimate contenders. But guess what? Obviously, they're not on the stage. So the other day, what is left to do? If the law is made unfairly against the mass of Americans, if the law twists democracy in its intent and its practice, if the law forbids representatives of people who millions of other people could vote for, I'm going to vote for Jill Stein. I know people who are going to vote for Jill Stein. I know people who call my radio show and other people I've talked to who are going to vote for the Libertarian Party candidate. I would never do that for various reasons, but there it is. The estimates, the low estimate of the number of the percentage of voters in this country that are going to vote for these candidates is something like 2%. I've seen estimates as high as 4% of people that might vote for these combined candidates. Could be 2% of the people or 3 or 4% of people are going to vote for these people. You're talking about millions of voters like you and like me, regular people, right? Millions of voters are going to exercise their right to choose who's going to be their president and control their very lives and spend their tax money and kill people overseas or not, and, you know, arrest bankers or not, and approve drilling for oil wells and gas wells on public land or aquifers or off the coasts. All of these people who are going to make these life and death decisions, which will affect the entire planet, which will keep us either in debt or take us out of debt or whatever it is, people who can help us with Social Security, with cost of living. And millions of people want to vote, people who could do single payer, people who are against not just these two wars, which maybe, you know, one of them may be winding down, the last one now, but still these incursions by the president. He's just put this, you know, this president who boasts about winding down one war and then he's going to wind down another one, of course, not fast enough and not in a way that helps anybody, really. But he's already putting, in case you didn't notice, guess what? We don't have enough trouble. He is, because of he's been pushed about Libya, because he basically screwed up and didn't provide enough, you know, prevention security detail for the ambassador, and what other complexities there are, I don't know. Well, actually, I do know, but I'm not going to get into. So basically, they screwed up between him and Hillary Clinton. And although their budget is tight because the Republicans cut money off for the security budget for the State Department. Did you know that? Still, they didn't. The colonel in charge of security in Libya, or in that area there, told the State Department in no uncertain terms, very clearly, only a couple of weeks before that or a month before that, that it's vastly inadequate, the security protection for what happened for the diplomats and for the consulate in Benghazi and the embassy in Tripoli. Told them, he said, this is ridiculous. People are going to get hurt. People could get killed. This is a dangerous place. They didn't do anything about it. They couldn't find money in their budget for it. Republicans had cut money from there, and one of the items they cut was, or criticized, was the security budget for the State Department. How they could do that is beyond me, right? So meanwhile, they just screwed up, and then they lied about it, and they were covering up and shuffling around because they didn't want to admit they did anything wrong. Usual crap from these people, right? And now they're all thundering about how they're going to find the people that did this. The people that did this are them. All they have to do is look in the mirror if they want to find out who did it. They didn't provide enough security for these people. They screwed up. So meanwhile, this is what's happened. So meanwhile, what is the president doing? He's going to track down these evil murderers in Libya, right, who are probably all carrying weapons that we supplied. And he's going to get them and make them pay for what they did. So how is he going to do this? It's inevitable. He is already, according to several reports that I've read in various places, and it was in the New York Times too, detailed soldiers to help lead so there are what they call boots on the ground. We've done it again. We have gone into yet another Middle Eastern country in the midst of, you know, anarchy, chaos, and violence where we don't belong, and we have actually put soldiers down on the ground. They may be contractors, they may be soldiers, they may be CIA people, but according to a report, there are American soldiers on the ground in Libya. Drone activity has been ratcheted up, and there are soldiers on the ground helping to, quote-unquote, train and aid the people in Libya who are tracking down these evil murderers, right? A murderer is a murderer, so I'm not going to do evil, but it's happening again. This is how it was in Vietnam, for Christ's sake. They started out with advisors. They call them advisors. They call them training troops. It's the same goddamn crap over and over and over again if you let them get it. So meanwhile, you want to vote for a person who's going to be in charge of these things, right? The commander-in-chief, the executive branch, is out of control. Out of control. They have dictatorial powers, which they are exercising. They order the government to spy on us, and that includes Obama. He was worse. He's worse than Bush, right? They order the government to spy on us. They allow people to torture people. They lock up whistleblowers, and they put troops and drones in so many countries. Over 130 countries have bases, troops, or drones from American, from the you know, American armed forces and the CIA. And so you want to vote, right? You want to vote for somebody. I want to vote. I don't want to vote for anybody who does that stuff, who has a personal kill list. I want to vote for somebody like Jill Stein, who wants single payer, who wants us out of all these countries because we don't need to be there, right? Who wants to go after the bankers, because Obama has never touched any one big major bank, and he's never, you know, now because he's running for office and wants more votes, suddenly the Justice Department, the SEC, is getting a little tough with some of the bankers, his friends, in other words. So I want to vote for Jill Stein. Other people want to vote for Gary Johnson, whatever your point of view is politically. And you want to hear what they have to say. If they were up on the stage, if Jill Stein was up there on that stage and Gary Johnson as a libertarian, you would hear a far more interesting debate. First of all, you would hear points of view that are backed by and established by, you know, that are representative of, I should say, maybe 10, 20 million people. There's a lot of people, and I hear this all the time. Some people aren't so polite about it when they write on, you know, the Occupied Territory Facebook page. They get really carried away. And people, a lot of people are angry at me from my point of view here. They say, I'm going to lose the election like the Green Party lost it to Bush because they voted in Florida against Gore. You know, didn't vote for Gore. They voted for Nader. Yeah, not really. Not exactly. But You know, so I'm getting a lot of heavy flack for this, to put it mildly, worse than I've gotten in 35 years, because I support her. Because I want the opportunity to vote for somebody who believes in what I believe, who says they will do what I want them to do as president. That is my right, and certainly that is what I want when I vote. But I can't see my candidate get up and debate. Imagine if Jill Stein, who is for single payer, who for stopping all these drone, attacks on civilians, for going after bankers aggressively, for instituting what's called a Robin Hood tax, which is a one penny tax on the trillions of stock and bond and derivative trades that happen with lightning speed by computers all day long. By investment banks and brokerage firms and other organizations and hedge funds. A one penny tax would add up to several hundred billion dollars a year. Who wants to aggressively go after tax dodgers, corporate tax dodgers and rich people? Wants to get the corporate rate up to a legitimate 35%, not a fake 35%. Wants to do away with loopholes and other tax laws that allow people like Mitt Romney, this sleazy son of a bitch, to pay 14% of his taxes when you and I and everybody else who work, for a living, have to have 35% or 33% or 30% of our taxes after deductions taken out of our check. We can't do anything about it, right? So she wants to do all this stuff. In fact, a lot of the people who are upset with me for pushing Jill Stein and for promoting her candidacy, and she's been on my show on Sirius a couple of times and will be on again. And today, I guess we sort of missed, crossed wires somehow with Sherry, but she'll be on, I hope, next week. A lot of people are angry at me for this because it'll take away from be realistic, they say. Be realistic, they say. You know what? We live in a world where we're subject to fate. There's fate. I believe in fate. Some people have just sort of better fates, and sometimes fate takes bad twists or good twists. Sometimes it's just plain bad luck or good luck that you run into, right? There are forces that clearly are out of your control that you can't do much about, sometimes. But still, to the extent that it's a democracy, there is a certain way in which we make our own reality. And I am constantly hearing from people about this issue. It's not realistic. It's unrealistic and idealistic and childish. It's unrealistic to vote for Jill Stein and encourage other people to do it. She has no chance of winning. Yes, I know she has no chance of winning. But I want to vote for somebody who actually represents me. Wouldn't you like to? And here's the kicker. 90% of the people who criticize people like me who promote Jill Stein and who push her candidacy and talk about how she would be a better president than these two corporate farts that are up there. 90% of the people who disagree with this and who yell at me because it's unrealistic, which it is not in some ways, actually, if they could vote for their ideal candidate, and I've seen this happen, they would vote for Jill Stein. Most of these people who are voting for Obama because it's the realistic thing to do, if they could really vote for a candidate who really represents them, would vote for Jill Stein. And so, aside from fate, and aside from luck, and aside from certain forces that are out of your control, like personal illness, or God knows people get laid off, or large forces in society that are hard to fight because they're repressive, you make your own reality. And so it's unrealistic to say that people who support the Green Party candidate are being unrealistic. The real reality is what you make it, or what you try to make it. It would be a reality that she would be up on that stage in the debates. It would be reality that she would have more federal funds, and it wouldn't be, and we could get rid of these Citizens United laws. It would be a reality that she could actually run and count and be something in the world if people made it a reality. If we boycotted and pushed major media organizations to cover her, I don't think MSNBC, which is the only national liberal, I would never say left-wing, but the only national liberal, I mean, they're Democratic Party cheerleaders, basically, but some of them you might call like Rachel Maddow occasionally, and maybe once in a while Sharpton, some of these people, they are somewhat liberal, or sometimes very liberal, but never left-wing, of course. They couldn't be on TV. But I don't think that that MSNBC, which is the only national exposure for any liberal or left-wing point of view on any major television network or station, have had Jill Stein or Sherry Hunkela, who is a vice presidential candidate, very powerful, very intelligent, very dynamic people who represent millions of other voters in this country, aside from the major parties. They haven't been on their show, as far as I know, or they've been on for 1 minute, or they haven't even mentioned them. They don't even exist. They don't even exist on the liberal channel. They hardly exist in a paper which is basically a moderate Democratic paper, the New York Times, and other newspapers, CNN, ABC, all these other places. There is no such thing as the Green Party. They're just a bunch of liberal, crazy, you know, nuts who are perverse and want to bring down our democratic system. No, in fact, they're exactly the opposite. They're people who want to actually put into action the theory of democracy. They want to represent a wider group of people. They truly do represent the common welfare and the common good of most people in this country. And so they were frozen out of the debates the other day illegally by this corporate duopoly of the Democrats and the Republicans. So they went there and said, we would like to participate in a debate. We are legitimate candidates who represent millions of voters, potentially millions of voters. We're on the ballot in 85% of the states in this country. And we qualify for appearance on the stage, according to your own presidential debate commission. What happens? They get arrested by the cops. Is this a democracy we live in? When you want to choose in reality between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, when you want to choose, you make a realistic choice, you're not getting a Democratic choice. That is not a realistic Democratic choice. If two companies, two giant companies who controlled an entire industry, and you're close to that with something like Microsoft and Google. If Microsoft and Google are always fighting each other, or Apple, right? They're always fighting each other. If they all got together and colluded to control to control the prices and basically to jack up the prices, which they do sometimes, but if they all got together and basically talked behind the scenes, and this happens all the time. If you've heard of the LIBOR scandal, most of the big banks in the world got together with government agencies and themselves. They got together and they fixed the price of money in the world, how much money and what the rate of loans would be for student loans and every other kind of loan, and colluded and jacked it up. It's illegal. It's so big and so vast that I don't think governments in the world have a chance to even prosecute them, to go after them, because they're bigger than the governments in the world. But if two giant companies got together, and this has happened before in our history when we had the guts to do anything about it, right, when some president had the balls to do anything about it, man or woman, I use that phrase in kind of a metaphorical way. When somebody had the guts to do anything about it, like Teddy Roosevelt, this is called a monopoly. It's called restraint of trade. It's unfair trade practices. It's not equal. It's tilting the playing field. Now, the Democrats and the Republicans have basically violated the basic rules of fairness. If they were companies, they could be prosecuted for doing this. They are freezing out a competitor in the marketplace, put it that way. And it's outrageous. Here is a woman, and if you've ever listened to Jill Stein or heard her be interviewed, who is extremely acute, aware, she's good-hearted, she's intelligent, she knows what she's doing, and she represents your point of view and my point of view far better than these two expensive-suited corporate stooges up on that stage. There's a program on PRN called the Black Agenda. I think it's called Black Agenda Report Radio. Black Agenda Radio. Check it out. They have a great point of view. It's basically run. Black Agenda Report is online. It's a site you can go to and you should check that out. But they have a radio show here too. Can you tell me when it is? Do we know what day and time it is? Okay, so it's Mondays at 11 a.m. Check this out. The guy in charge is named Glenn Ford. He's an old sort of activist and street fighter from the 60s. Goes way back, right? And this guy is really on top of everything. And this guy, and he'll tell you what he thinks about Obama from a black point of view, right? And he'll tell you what he thinks about him from a sort of a socialist point of view and from a liberal left point of view. So Black Agenda Radio, which is at 11 a.m. on Mondays, a lot of good programs on this station. Check out our lineup. So basically, this is what you have. I look at this debate. I see two people who are basically, you know, different in some ways, who clearly have divisions and differences. Would things be worse if you voted for if Romney got elected rather than Obama? The country would get poisoned slower. There would be a dictatorship at a slower pace. There are civil rights would disappear, and our constitutional rights would disappear more slowly. We would certainly have more and bigger insane wars if Romney got elected. So the question is the same old tiresome thing, the lesser of two evils. Who do you want to run things, right? I mean, do you want Coke? Do you want Pepsi? Which one is going to rot your liver slower, you know, or your spleen or whatever it is it does to you, right? I mean, choose your poison, but wouldn't it be refreshing if you could, and think of Gary Null, natural living. Wouldn't it be a natural, refreshing, democratic, decent thing to do to at least see your candidate, Jill Stein is my candidate, up on the debate stage? And as I said before, if you had the Libertarian candidate up there, and you had Romney, and you had Obama, and then you had Jill Stein up there, and they all got equal time, right? And it would be interesting, too, to have a woman up there, wouldn't it? With these two guys basically trying to beat each other over the head, right? Who's the bigger guy? Did you see that? You know when you often see the way they acted? When you watch two male dogs. They were like two male dogs or bulls. It's like watching a National Geographic film. Romney walks out, occupies the middle of the space, which he's used to doing as a browbeating rich guy and a salesman, right? And a CEO of a company. He walks out and occupies the middle of the space. The president, right? He walks out and occupies the middle of the space. Now, so theoretically, I keep reading that they're competing for the votes of women. I think probably women saw that Romney was an even, you know, bigger bully than the other guy was, right? Not that Obama's not a bully type, but clearly Romney is nothing but a bully. He's a paternalistic bully son of a bitch. And women could see that. Women could easily see that, right? But women also, according to a lot of polls and a lot of studies I read, they don't like men making a lot of noise and fighting with each other. It bores them. It's stupid. They look down on it. They just want to see somebody who's compassionate, who's got a real plan to fix things. If they saw Jill Stein, they'd see somebody to vote for, but you don't get to see her. Because the giant media corporations and then, you know, that run everything, especially on television, the networks and the other places on TV that run things that aren't on satellite, that are part of terrestrial TV, and I guess this includes cable too, I'm pretty sure, MSNBC, all these places like that, they are licensed by you and me. They hold licenses from the people of the United States of America. What a joke. If they actually were held to account, if they're supposed to operate in the public interest, that's the funniest thing you ever heard, right? NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox, MSNBC, these places are supposed to operate in the public interest. So Chris Matthews comes on, screams and yells about, the rights of the middle class and the working man. Ed Schultz screams and yells about this. But we don't see a candidate who would really represent actual people. They talk about the attack on women by Republicans. True enough. It's vicious and vile, the fundamentalists, the Republicans, right? And certainly Obama has a better record there. But you don't actually see, God forbid, that they would have a woman on their show who's running for president. A decent, caring, intelligent, passionate, forthright woman. No way. Not in a million years. Is that in the public interest? It makes me mad. Do I sound angry? I am angry. And you should be angry. So no matter who you would vote for, we should have the right to see these two candidates up there. And if Jill Stein was up there, a woman, and way to the left, and I say left, it's a category that's almost meaningless, she does represent the real views and feelings of most of Americans, whether they know it or not. And even when they do know it, you know, she represents them. And then you have the Libertarian candidate, who also represents tens of millions of people's viewpoints on war. They don't want to spend the money on the war. Maybe not for the right reasons. They don't want the government to do anything, right? But, I do want the government to do things, but I don't want them spending money on war. But imagine if those two people were up there. Just picture it. If the two of them were up there during that debate and had equal time, you would get the widest possible spread of information. You would suddenly get issues brought up that these two people have colluded, the Democrats and Republicans, not to hear anything about. You're not going to have Obama ever say anything about the fact that at the very moment he was debating Romney, that Romney was shipping a company that Bain Capital owns, where he still makes money from all the time, despite the fact he says it doesn't work there, which is bullshit. You know, I mean, he gets plenty of his income from Bain Capital all the time through some, you know, derivative offshore account or whatever, structured something. Bain Capital, at the moment he was up there, they were arresting workers in Freeport, Illinois, at a gigantic plant that used to make automotive parts that was making a profit. But his company and, you know, under Bain Capital, and he had some part in this, too, they closed the plant down and were shipping and were in the process the other day of doing the final shipments of all the parts of this plant off to China. They laid off 3,500 workers making good salaries. And, you know, the echo effect is immense. 3,500 family workers who are making decent, really good salaries, 50,000, 60,000, 70,000, you know, with benefits and everything, laid them all off and shipped the jobs to China. And he's up there. Did you hear Mr. Obama say one damn thing about that? Did you hear Biden say one thing to Paul Ryan about the fact that while he represents his district in Wisconsin, that the city that he lives in a big, comfortable, rich house with his rich wife, his banker lobbyist wife, that place is devastated. It's devastated. Absolutely, like a nuclear bomb hit it. There are so many lost jobs and factories closed down and jobs outsourced to China. There are people, the domestic abuse rate has gone through the roof. Suicides, drug use, depression, because everybody had lost their jobs. This is what he is presiding over. It's just bad form, though. You don't want to get into that. You heard Ryan bring up one thing about Scranton, where people are unemployed. He's willing to do it. You know, he's willing to do it. You know, that's Biden's hometown, right? Or a town that Biden is associated with. But it's considered bad form to talk about the other gentleman's devastation and criminal behavior. You just don't do that. I mean, after all, we're gentlemen here at the club, right? Democrats and Republicans, the political club, we blackball people who aren't one of us. These people make me sick, and they should make you sick. And imagine if Jill Stein was up there, and she's bringing up the drone attacks and how many civilians were killed, right? Romney's not going to bring that up, because he would kill even more people. They both agree that it's the president's right to murder people all over the world without the approval of Congress, to actually declare wars without the approval of Congress, i.e. the will of the people of the United States. They can kill people, they can murder people, they can lock people up for no good reason and keep you in jail forever. They can authorize torture and deny that it exists. They can refrain from going after bankers who should all be locked up and their money taken away so they could be redistributed to real people in this country. They won't aggressively attack tax dodgers and corporate and personal. They won't do any of these things. And it's a gentleman's agreement between the two of them. And the rest of us are screwed. I've got a fish tank at home. And there are little tiny 2-inch long tropical fish in it, right? They are in this tank. They're not going anywhere. There's nowhere they can go. And they get fed what I want, how I want, and when I want. Otherwise, they don't eat. We're voters out there. We're voting for people who control our destinies, our lives, who could fry the planet or else save it, who could kill people or else not kill people, who could fund teachers and dams and rivers, bridges, who could build cities up again, who could build alternative energy sources, who could put down pipelines and destroy the earth. We're voting for people who send other people all over the world to murder people, half the time innocent people. We're voting for all this stuff. We're voting for people who could put bankers in jail, turn Wall Street around, put them in jail where they belong, take their money away and give it to people who they cheated and, you know, who could save people's homes, who could put caps on the price of gas, who could do all kinds of things. And we don't have a representative of that we believe in up there to see. So vote for whoever you want. But wouldn't you really like to see a real democracy in action? So instead of having Jill Stein up on the platform to represent a real woman's point of view and a point of view of probably tens of millions of people in this country about war, about Wall Street, about mortgages, about student debt, about everything else, about single payer. Instead of having that, you have her in jail. Is this the country that we want to live in? I would never vote for Obama. He's just a different color suit up on that corporate stage, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, I'll say it one last time. He's somewhat better than the other guy. We would go to hell faster if we voted for Romney. We'd get screwed faster, but it's still happening. The day after Obama gets elected, if he gets elected, and even if he has a Congress that cooperates with him, you think any of these things are going to get better? Income inequality, the environment, drilling, single payer, you think any of that's going to happen? You're fooling yourself. You're fooling yourself. Jill Stein belongs up on that platform. All right, that's it for now. We'll have find out what happened with Sherry Hunkelow, who's the vice presidential candidate. Maybe we can get her on next week. Something happened with her. Okay, check out Occupy Territory, our Facebook page, and I'll be back Monday for my other show that I do here called The Turning Point, which I advise you to tune in for because it's not about politics. Wouldn't that be refreshing? It's about life. It's about children, sex, marriage, destiny, eternity, religion, from a personal point of view. And I'll be back the week after this with another Occupied Territory with some interesting guests. Okay, that's it for today.